Arkansas medical marijuana patients voice concern over the program's future as state lawmakers get new power to change it. A new exhibit looks at public education for Black students in the Jim Crow era, and a natural state jazz group pays tribute to some early classics. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. The Arkansas Supreme Court ruled last month that state lawmakers can amend citizen-led constitutional amendments. That decision has some patients worried about the future of the state's medical marijuana program. The Arkansas Advocate's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Emily Williams struggled to find medication that alleviated chemotherapy side effects like nausea and loss of appetite following her 2010 cancer diagnosis. Eventually, she tried marijuana, and it provided relief.
I was just grateful. I just felt grateful.
The experience prompted the Fayetteville retiree to advocate for a citizen-led constitutional amendment that voters approved in 2016 to create Arkansas's medical marijuana program. The program has since grown into a billion-dollar industry with more than 115,000 patients using marijuana to treat conditions from Crohn's disease to post-traumatic stress disorder. But an obscure legal fight over who can change citizen-led amendments to Arkansas's Constitution casts uncertainty on the program's future. The court ruling is part of a nationwide battle playing out in states like Missouri and Nebraska over citizen-led ballot measures. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Arkansas is one of 24 states that allow citizens to propose state laws. Since the state's first dispensary opened in 2019, thousands of Arkansans have accessed the program, including Christopher Duffy, a 35-year-old Fayetteville resident who says medical marijuana helped his anxiety and sobriety. Duffy says he'd remain committed to sobriety if marijuana becomes less accessible, but he worries about others.
I'm lucky to have such a support system where were things to get tough or I started struggling, I could reach out. There are those that don't have that, and I fear for them.
Williams, who's now 69, says she's afraid of losing access to medical marijuana, which she uses to manage ongoing complications from her illness.
If I am not able to use this, my life would be completely negatively impacted.
These concerns were sparked by the Arkansas Supreme Court upending 74 years of precedent in December with a ruling that declared lawmakers can amend citizen-led constitutional amendments with a two-thirds vote, 67 votes in the House and 24 votes in the Senate. The decision stemmed from a case challenging the legislature's passage of laws amending the Arkansas Medical Marijuana Amendment. However, lawmakers' newly affirmed authority extends beyond medical marijuana to other citizen-led amendments, including those that affect casinos. David Couch, a Little Rock lawyer who helped write the medical marijuana amendment, says the court's decision absolutely adds more pressure that a new ballot measure he's backing be successful. If the measure, which was proposed by Save Our Democracy, qualifies for the 2026 ballot and is approved by voters, it would prohibit lawmakers from changing the Arkansas Constitution themselves and require voters to approve any new law affecting the initiative and referendum process. Although he understands how the court arrived at its conclusion, Couch says the justices erred in their application.
The thing that bothers me the most is they applied it retroactively, not prospectively. They upended, you know, 115 years of work by the people of the state of Arkansas on these initiatives.
Knoxville Republican Representative Aaron Pilkington says the court's ruling affirmed what he long believed to be true. However, he doesn't think lawmakers are chomping at the bit to alter popular amendments. Pilkington took office in 2017, just after 53% of voters approved medical marijuana. While Republicans weren't generally in favor of it, Pilkington notes the party's leaders didn't stand in the way of what voters asked for.
I think we've actually shown a history of even if maybe the legislature doesn't necessarily agree with it, they're still going to honor the wishes of the voters. Because had we not, had we tried to forced this issue back then or caused this and that, I think you would have seen, repercussions in those next elections.
Pilkington has since sponsored legislation on medical marijuana, including an unsuccessful effort to allow dispensaries to deliver. Pilkington says there may be some tinkering to the program, but he's not really open to amending it, given the increasing revenue from sales that funds certain programs. According to the state's Department of Finance and Administration, Arkansans spent a record $291.1 million on medical marijuana in 2025. Legislation approved last year allows tax revenue from those sales to support free breakfast for students. Though it may be used sparingly, Pilkington says the authority to amend the state's constitution could be useful to address policies that aren't working the way they were intended or to reflect a shift in perspective that's occurred since an amendment was first approved. Senate President Bart Hester says it also allows lawmakers to address issues that require immediate attention instead of waiting 2 years to present a measure to voters. The Arkansas Constitution can be changed when voters approve a measure proposed by lawmakers or by citizens who must qualify for the ballot by circulating petitions. Proposed amendments may be considered every 2 years during the general election. Republicans currently have a supermajority in both the House and Senate, but Hester says a two-thirds vote is a huge, hard bar to meet, regardless of which party has a majority. The Cave Springs Republican says lawmakers will only use this authority when absolutely necessary and will likely wait until the 2027 legislative session to review citizen-led amendments, such as those that received a lot of financial support from out-of-state interests. Hester also mentioned reviewing measures related to medical marijuana and casinos because they were huge amendments with multiple provisions.
I think that it might be reasonable that the legislature look at them a little bit at a time versus holistically. And I think that's the responsible thing to do to make sure the people of Arkansas's interests are represented.
Hester says lawmakers can only amend the marijuana amendment, not repeal it. While the legislature may not intend to overrule voters, Duffy says he believes there are some lawmakers willing to do so. Therefore, he's hopeful Save Our Democracy's ballot measure will succeed. The group needs to collect nearly 91,000 signatures by July 3rd to qualify for the ballot.
I don't see any intent from the legislature to override the will of the people, but I feel like there are some that are willing to do that. And that is what's concerning.
Should the measure fail and lawmakers head into the 2027 legislative session with their court-affirmed amendment authority, Duffy says he could see them increasing medical marijuana taxes. That could prompt patients to purchase from neighboring states like Missouri, where recreational marijuana is also legal, driving revenue out of Arkansas. Williams is skeptical about lawmakers' restraint and said she believes they intend to, quote, gut it to the extent that it is almost impossible to use.
I would like to ask one of these legislators if they know what it feels like to get up in the morning and wonder how sick you're going to feel that day.
That was the Arkansas Advocate's Antoinette Grajeda reporting. Next month, the Black History Commission of Arkansas and the Arkansas State Archives will host Shaping the Future of Black Education Then and Now at the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in Little Rock. Among the speakers is Ralph Wilcox, National Register and Survey Coordinator at the Arkansas Historic Preservation Program. He spoke about his topic, Rosenwald Schools in Arkansas and the Greater South, with KUAF's Kyle Kellums.
Rosenwald schools were schools for African Americans that were partially funded by Julius Rosenwald, who was president of Sears and Roebuck in the early 20th century. He believed that African American education was a cause that he could really make a difference in. And so he gave grants for African American schools all across the southern United States.
Many of these schools, if not all of them, built in places where young Black students were not afforded equal education opportunities.
That is correct. And that was part of the reason why he did it, is he felt that if he provided funds to help construct schools, it would give African Americans a better education because they would have better facilities in which to learn in.
He was a contemporary of and a friend of Booker T. Washington?
Yes, he was inspired by Booker T. Washington's autobiography and met Booker T. Washington. And Booker T. Washington asked Julius Rosenwald to serve on the board of trustees of Tuskegee University in Alabama. And it was that partnership and that friendship that led to the Rosenwald School program. Both Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington were very much into improving African-American education, and their friendship and partnership led to the program.
Any idea how much money Rosenwald contributed over the decades for the construction of Rosenwald schools?
Off the top of my head, I don't know, but it was many millions of dollars over the course of the program. The program started in the mid-19-teens, and the school building part of the Rosenwald Fund ceased operation in 1932.
Any idea how many schools were built in total?
It was a little over 5,000 throughout the southeastern U.S.
5,000. How many do we think were in Arkansas?
In Arkansas, if I remember right, there were just under 400 that were built originally between about 1920 and 1932. Today, less than 20 of those survive.
What do we know about the schools physically? What did they look like? What did they contain? How were students housed?
The schools varied in design. It depended on what was needed in a particular community. The schools varied from one room to the largest in Arkansas is Dunbar Junior High School in Little Rock, which was a junior high school, and a junior college all in one. And of course, that building has multiple rooms. They were supposed to have been built on a minimum of 2 acres so that not only would you have the school building, but you would have space for playground, athletic facilities, you know, such as a baseball field. And I believe there was also space to do such things as community gardens. They were really meant to not only be a school, but also in certain respects to be the center of the community.
Were Rosenwald schools just school buildings, or were there other buildings that were constructed in this process?
The Rosenwald Fund funded school buildings, teachers' homes, shop buildings, and also additions to existing schools.
Were white communities near the Rosenwald schools, were they welcoming? Did they ignore this? Were there any challenges?
I don't know about challenges. I know that there were In funding for the schools, funding came from several different sources. Funding came from the local community. Funding came from Julius Rosenwald. And there was also public funding involved. So at least to a certain extent, the white community was involved, at least through public funding, if they didn't do their own funding. I don't know that there were any challenges to the schools, at least not that I've heard about around Arkansas. As far as I know, the white community, at least on some level, was accepting.
So a little bit more than 5,000 Rosenwald schools across the South. How would this happen? Would you have to have a liaison in a community or in a state to make sure this worked?
Of course, you would have the State Board of Education involved. Also, a lot of them were spearheaded by a church. A local African-American church would often kind of start the ball rolling to help raise the funds to get, you know, the grant from Rosenwald. So when you look at the schools, a lot of them were in proximity to a church building, if not on the same parcel as a church.
You'll be presenting a talk about Rosenwald Schools and Julius Rosenwald soon. Tell me a little bit more about that weekend event.
It's part of a symposium that is put on by the Arkansas State Archives and the Black History Commission of Arkansas. They do symposia once or twice or three times a year. And the focus of this one coming up in February is African-American education, and I will be one of the speakers at that symposium.
You mentioned that it was in the 30s when the fund ended for these schools. Do we know approximately when the schools themselves stopped being used? Was it then, or was it, did it sort of trickle until the Supreme Court, you know, Brown versus Education?
Yeah, the schools were used way beyond the 30s. Some of them, or a lot of them, went out of use when desegregation occurred. Because what often happened is, even though the Rosenwald Building was, you know, just as good as the white school that was also being used at that time, unfortunately, there was a stigma. And so a lot of the schools stopped being used when desegregation occurred. In fact, the only one that is still in use in Arkansas that I know of is Dunbar.
The other buildings that still stand in Arkansas, what kind of condition are they in? Does it vary?
It does vary. A lot of them are endangered, quite honestly. There are several that are not being used and are just decaying. A couple of them that are still in pretty good shape, one in Selma in Drew County, is used as a community center. And then there is also one in Arkadelphia, Peak High School, which is still in pretty good shape and actively used.
Most of the Rosenwald schools in Arkansas were in the southern part of the state, though there were a couple that got into close to the Arkansas River, right?
Yeah, there was, let me think. I think there was one, if I remember right, in Logan County, which was really kind of the furthest northwest that they went. The vast majority of them were in the southeastern half of the state, in the agricultural areas and in the timber areas. The study of the Rosenwald schools in Arkansas began in 2002, as a result of the National Trust for Historic Preservation putting them on their most endangered list that year. Nothing had really been done to study our state's schools before that. There were a couple that were listed on the National Register individually, but no kind of systematic study or survey to see what was remaining. So a lot of what we have learned about our Rosenwald schools has occurred in the past 23, 24 years.
That was Ralph Wilcox with the Arkansas Historic Preservation Program speaking with KUAF's Kyle Kellums. His lecture, titled Rosenwald Schools in Arkansas and the Greater South, is set for February 7th at the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in downtown Little Rock. An Arkansas jazz group has a new album out. Drummer and Searcy resident Hal Smith leads the Telegraph Avenue Jazzmen. He spoke about their new album, a musical tribute to Ted Schaefer's Jelly Roll Jazz Band, with KASU's Marty Scarborough.
Tell us a little bit about the artist to whom you're paying tribute on this new album, Ted Schaefer and his Jelly Roll Jazz Band.
Ted was a banjo player originally from Rochester, New York, who wound up in Los Angeles and put together a band modeled on the Lou Waters band of the 1940s, using two cornets in the front line instead of just one. Two cornets, trombone, clarinet, piano, banjo, tuba, and drums. They played arrangements from a band that existed previously called the Great Pacific Jazz Band, plus that was a Bay Area band, by the way, and a few extra arrangements written at a later time. That band was active in Los Angeles for quite a while, and Ted, when he moved to the Bay Area, also had the band working up there. But at the same time, Ted had a similar taste to mine. He really liked small band New Orleans jazz and put together a smaller edition of the Jelly Roll Jazz Band that played even more engagements around the Bay Area. And that band featured one of my heroes, Papa Ray Ronnie, on cornet. And we've talked about him before on some of my other projects. But he recorded with Ted at made some live recordings at a place called the Straw Hat Pizza Palace in Oakland, California, located on Telegraph Avenue. And that's where I picked the name for this band. And it's based on those recordings, those live recordings from 1967 featuring Papa Ray on cornet. And this is another remote recording because there's no way I could have afforded the airfares to make this work.
Well, we'll talk in a moment about how the unique way in which this and some of your other projects have been recorded. But a couple more questions about Ted Schaefer and the music that was being made out in California at this time. Why do you think that there was a resurgence, particularly in California, for bands playing in these early styles of jazz music?
That was really ground zero for the New Orleans revival. There were parallel revivals, one in New Orleans and another in the Bay Area of San Francisco. And the one in the Bay Area was pioneered by Lou Waters, who formed the Yerba Buena Jazz Band and spawned the Turk Murphy Jazz Band, the Bob Scobie Jazz Band, several other groups, including the Firehouse 5+2, probably the most famous traditional jazz band of all time. But since it started in California, that's where the mass audience for that music was. And that continued well into the rock and roll era. It wasn't until, I'd say, the early 1970s that the engagements for traditional jazz bands started to disappear all over California.
Okay, we've talked about the music. Let's hear some of it now. I'd like you to tell me why you chose to record some of these songs and any noteworthy stories about them. And let's start with one that may be the most familiar to people, the Charleston. Tell us about why you chose to record that.
I've always liked the song. I think it's one of the greatest written by James P. Johnson, the father of stride piano, the mentor of Thomas Fats Waller, and a great American composer. He also wrote If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight and Old Fashioned Love. And I don't think as many people know that he wrote the Charleston as those other two songs, but he based the Charleston on dances from his ancestors in South Carolina. This is the kind of dance that they would do. And it's a very distinctive rhythm. It's been called the dance that made the 20s roar.
And if you ever see a movie from that takes place in the 1920s, this is part of the soundtrack. Yeah, even if they not recognize the title, they have heard this tune with that rhythm somewhere, if anybody's been involved in any kind of popular culture for the last 50 years.
That's right. Also, this includes the very rare verse. Usually, when it's the Charleston's played in a film or on TV, it's just the chorus. But the verse really sets up the chorus, in my opinion. And I've always liked it. I always thought that's one of the best verses in jazz.
Cersei-based jazz drummer Hal Smith speaking with KASU's Marty Scarborough. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.